Mudfog and Other Sketches. Contents. I Public Life of Mr. Tolrumble, Once Mayor of Mudfog 2. Full report of the first meeting of the Mudfog Association for the Advancement of Everything 3. Full report of the second meeting of the Mudfog Association for the Advancement of Everything IV. The Pantomime of Life V. Some Particulars Concerning the Lion VI. Mr. Robert Bolton. The gentleman connected with the presses via familiar epistle from a parent to a child aged 2 years and 2 months. Public Life of Mr. Tolrumble, Once Mayor of Mudfog. Mudfog is a pleasant town, a remarkably pleasant town situated in a charming hollow by the side of a river, from which river, Mudfog derives an agreeable scent of pitch, tar, coals, and rope yarn, a roving population in oilskin hats, a pretty steady influx of drunken bargemen, and a great many other maritime advantages. There is a good deal of water about Mudfog, and yet it is not exactly the sort of town for a watering place either. Water is a perverse sort of element at the best of times, and in Mudfog it is particularly so. In winter, it comes oozing down the streets and tumbling over the fields, nay, rushes into the very cellars and kitchens of the houses, with a lavish prodigality that might well be dispensed with. But in the hot summer weather it will dry up, and turn green. And, although green is a very good color in its way, especially in grass, still it certainly is not becoming to water, and it cannot be denied that the beauty of Mudfog is rather impaired, even by this trifling circumstance. Mudfog is a healthy place, very healthy, damp, perhaps, but none the worse for that. It's quite a mistake to suppose that damp is unwholesome. Plants thrive best in damp situations, and why shouldn't men? The inhabitants of Mudfog are unanimous in asserting that there exists not a finer race of people on the face of the earth. Here we have an indisputable and voracious contradiction of the vulgar error at once. So, admitting Mudfog to be damp, we distinctly state that it is salubrious. The town of Mudfog is extremely picturesque. Limehouse and Ratcliffe Highway are both something like it, but they give you a very faint idea of Mudfog. There are a great many more public houses in Mudfog more than in Ratcliffe Highway and Limehouse put together. The public buildings, too, are very imposing. We consider the town hall one of the finest specimens of shed architecture extant. It is a combination of the pigsty and tea garden box orders, and the simplicity of its design is of surpassing beauty. The idea of placing a large window on one side of the door and a small one on the other is particularly happy. There is a fine old Doric beauty, too, about the padlock and scraper, which is strictly in keeping with the general effect. In this room do the mayor and corporation of Mudfog assemble together in solemn council for the public weal. Seated on the massive wooden benches, which, with the table in the center, form the only furniture of the whitewashed apartment, the sage men of Mudfog spend hour after hour in grave deliberation. Here they settle at what hour of the night the public houses shall be closed, at what hour of the morning they shall be permitted to open, how soon it shall be lawful for people to eat their dinner on church days, and other great political questions. And sometimes, long after silence has fallen on the town, and the distant lights from the shops and houses have ceased to twinkle, like far-off stars, to the sight of the boatman on the river, the illumination in the two unequal-sized windows of the town hall warns the inhabitants of Mudfog that its little body of legislators, like a larger and better-known body of the same genus, a great deal more noisy and not a whit more profound, are patriotically dozing away in company, far into the night, for their country's good. Among this knot of sage and learned men, no one was so eminently distinguished, during many years, for the quiet modesty of his appearance and demeanor, as Nicholas Tolrumble, the well-known coal dealer. however exciting the subject of discussion, however animated the tone of the debate, or however warm the personalities exchanged, and even in Mudfog we get personal sometimes. Nicholas Tulrumble was always the same. To say truth, Nicholas, being an industrious man, and always up bedums, was apt to fall asleep when the debate began, and to remain asleep till it was over, when he would wake up very much refreshed, and give his vote with the greatest complacency. The fact was, that Nicholas Tulrumble, knowing that everybody there had made up his mind beforehand, considered the talking as just a long botheration about nothing at all. And to the present hour it remains a question, whether, on this point at all events, Nicholas Tulrumble was not pretty near right. Time, which strews a man's head with silver, sometimes fills his pockets with gold. As he gradually performed one good office for Nicholas Tulrumble, he was obliging enough not to omit the other. Nicholas began life in a wooden tenement of 4 feet square, with a capital of 2 and 9 pence, and a stock in trade of 3 bushels and a half of coals, exclusive of the large lump which hung, by way of signboard, outside. Then he enlarged the shed, and kept a truck. Then he left the shed, and the truck too, and started a donkey and a Mrs. Tulrumble. Then he moved again, and set up a cart. The cart was soon afterwards exchanged for a wagon, and so he went on like his great predecessor Whittington, only without a cat for a partner, increasing in wealth and fame, until at last he gave up business altogether, and retired with Mrs. Tulrumble and family to Mudfog Hall, which he had himself erected, on something which he attempted to delude himself into the belief was a hill, about a quarter of a mile distant from the town of Mudfog. About this time, it began to be murmured in Mudfog that Nicholas Tulrumble was growing vain and haughty, that prosperity and success had corrupted the simplicity of his manners, and tainted the natural goodness of his heart. In short, that he was setting up for a public character, and a great gentleman, and affected to look down upon his old companions with compassion and contempt. Whether these reports were at the time well-founded, or not, certain it is that Mrs. Tulrumble very shortly afterwards started a 4-wheel chaise, driven by a tall postillion in a yellow cap, that Mr. Tulrumble Jr. took to smoking cigars, and calling the footman a feller, apostrophe, and that Mr. Tulrumble from that time forth, was no more seen in his old seat in the chimney corner of the Lighterman's Arms at night. This looked bad. But, more than this, it began to be observed that Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble attended the corporation meetings more frequently than heretofore, and he no longer went to sleep as he had done for so many years, but propped his eyelids open with his 2 forefingers, that he read the newspapers by himself at home, and that he was in the habit of indulging a broad and distant, and mysterious allusions to masses of people, apostrophe, and the property of the country, apostrophe, and productive power, and the moneyed interest. All of which denoted and proved that Nicholas Tulrumble was either mad, or worse, and it puzzled the good people of Mudfog amazingly. At length, about the middle of the month of October, Mr. Tulrumble and family went up to London, the middle of October being, as Mrs. Tulrumble informed her acquaintance in Mudfog, the very height of the fashionable season. Somehow or other, just about this time, despite the health-preserving air of Mudfog, the mayor died. It was a most extraordinary circumstance. He had lived in Mudfog for 85 years. The corporation didn't understand it at all. Indeed, it was with great difficulty that one old gentleman, who was a great stickler for forms, was dissuaded from proposing a vote of censure on such unaccountable conduct. Strange as it was, however, die he did, without taking the slightest notice of the corporation, and the corporation were imperatively called upon to elect his successor. So, they met for the purpose, and being very full of Nicholas Tulrumble just then, and Nicholas Tulrumble being a very important man, they elected him, and rode off to London by the very next post, to acquaint Nicholas Tulrumble with his new elevation. Now, it being November time, and Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble being in the capital, it fell out that he was present at the Lord Mayor's show and dinner, at sight of the glory and splendor whereof, he, Mr. Tulrumble, was greatly mortified, inasmuch as the reflection would force itself on his mind, that, had he been born in London instead of in Mudfog, he might have been a Lord Mayor too, and have patronized the judges, and been affable to the Lord Chancellor, and friendly with the Premier, and coldly condescending to the Secretary to the Treasury, and have dined with a flag behind his back, and done a great many other acts and deeds which unto Lord Mayors of London peculiarly appertain. The more he thought of the Lord Mayor, the more enviable a personage he seemed. To be a king was all very well, but what was the king to the Lord Mayor? When the king made a speech, everybody knew it was somebody else's writing, whereas here was the Lord Mayor, talking away for half an hour all out of his own head amidst the enthusiastic applause of the whole company, while it was notorious that the king might talk to his parliament till he was black in the face without getting so much as a single cheer. As all these reflections passed through the mind of Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble, the Lord Mayor of London appeared to him the greatest sovereign on the face of the earth, beating the Emperor of Russia all to nothing, and leaving the Great Mogul immeasurably behind. Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble was pondering over these things, and inwardly cursing the fate which had pitched his coal shed in Mudfog, when the letter of the corporation was put into his hand. A crimson flush mantled over his face as he read it, for visions of brightness were already dancing before his imagination. "My dear," apostrophe said Mr. Tulrumble to his wife, "they have elected me mayor of Mudfog." Apostrophe, "Lore mussy." Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mrs. Tulrumble. "Why, what's become of old Snicks?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "the late Mr. Snicks, Mrs. Tulrumble," apostrophe, said Mr. Tulrumble sharply, for he by no means approved of the notion of unceremoniously designating a gentleman who filled the high office of mayor as old Snicks, apostrophe, "the late Mr. Snicks, Mrs. Tulrumble, is dead." Apostrophe, the communication was very unexpected. But Mrs. Tulrumble only ejaculated "Lore mussy!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, once again, as if a mayor were a mere ordinary Christian, at which Mr. Tulrumble frowned gloomily. "What a pity 'tan't in London, ain't it?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mrs. Tulrumble, after a short pause. "What a pity 'tan't in London, where you might have had a show." Apostrophe, "I might have a show in Mudfog, if I thought proper, I apprehend," apostrophe, said Mr. Tulrumble mysteriously. "Lor, so you might, I declare," apostrophe, replied Mrs. Tulrumble. "And a good one too," apostrophe, said Mr. Tulrumble. "Delightful," apostrophe, apostrophe, exclaimed Mrs. Tulrumble. "One which would rather astonish the ignorant people down there," apostrophe, said Mr. Tulrumble. "It would kill them with envy," apostrophe, said Mrs. Tulrumble. So it was agreed that His Majesty's lieges in Mudfog should be astonished with splendor, and slaughtered with envy, and that such a show should take place as had never been seen in that town, or in any other town before, no, not even in London itself. On the very next day after the receipt of the letter, down came the tall postillion in a post-chaise, not upon one of the horses, but inside, actually inside the chaise, and, driving up to the very door of the town hall, where the corporation were assembled, delivered a letter, written by the Lord knows who, and signed by Nicholas Tulrumble, in which Nicholas said, all through four sides of closely written, gilt-edged, hot-pressed, Bath Post letter paper, that he responded to the call of his fellow townsmen with feelings of heartfelt delight, that he accepted the arduous office which their confidence had imposed upon him, that they would never find him shrinking from the discharge of his duty, that he would endeavor to execute his functions with all that dignity which their magnitude and importance demanded, and a great deal more to the same effect. But even this was not all. The tall postillion produced from his right-hand top boot a damp copy of that afternoon's number of the county paper, and there, in large type, running the whole length of the very first column, was a long address from Nicholas Tulrumble to the inhabitants of Mudfog, in which he said that he cheerfully complied with their requisition, and, in short, as if to prevent any mistake about the matter, told them over again what a grand fellow he meant to be, in very much the same terms as those in which he had already told them all about the matter in his letter. The corporation stared at one another very hard at all this, and then looked as if for explanation to the tall postillion, but as the tall postillion was intently contemplating the gold tassel on the top of his yellow cap, and could have afforded no explanation whatever, even if his thoughts had been entirely disengaged, they contented themselves with coughing very dubiously, and looking very grave. The tall postillion then delivered another letter, in which Nicholas Tulrumble informed the corporation that he intended repairing to the town hall, in grand state and gorgeous procession, on the Monday afternoon next ensuing. At this the corporation looked still more solemn, but, as the epistle wound up with a formal invitation to the whole body, to dine with the mayor on that day, at Mudfog Hall, Mudfog Hill, Mudfog, they began to see the fun of the thing directly, and sent back their compliments, and they'd be sure to come. Now there happened to be in Mudfog, as somehow or other there does happen to be, in almost every town in the British dominions, and perhaps in foreign dominions too we think it very likely, but, being no great traveler, cannot distinctly say there happened to be, in Mudfog, a merry-tempered, pleasant-faced, good-for-nothing sort of vagabond, with an invincible dislike to manual labor, and an unconquerable attachment to strong beer and spirits, whom everybody knew, and nobody, except his wife, took the trouble to quarrel with, who inherited from his ancestors the appellation of Edward Twigger, and rejoiced in the sobriquet of Bottle-Nosed Ned. He was drunk upon the average once a day, and penitent upon an equally fair calculation once a month. And when he was penitent, he was invariably in the very last stage of maudlin intoxication. He was a ragged, roving, roaring kind of fellow, with a burly form, a sharp wit, and a ready head, and could turn his hand to anything, when he chose to do it. He was by no means opposed to hard labor on principle, for he would work away at a cricket match by the day together, running, and catching, and batting, and bowling, and reveling in toil which would exhaust a galley slave. He would have been invaluable to a fire office. Never was a man with such a natural taste for pumping engines, running up ladders, and throwing furniture out of two pair of stairs windows. Nor was this the only element in which he was at home. He was a humane society in himself, a portable drag, an animated life preserver, and had saved more people, in his time, from drowning, than the Plymouth lifeboat, or Captain Manby's apparatus. With all these qualifications, notwithstanding his dissipation, Bottle-Nosed Ned was a general favorite, and the authorities of Mudfog, remembering his numerous services to the population, allowed him in return to get drunk in his own way, without the fear of stocks, fine, or imprisonment. He had a general license, and he showed his sense of the compliment by making the most of it. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.